ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 21, The Gopis Glorify Krishna's Flute, text 11. Which hopefully will be here. Okay. Danyasma muda gatayopi harinya eta. Yananda nanda namupata vichitravesham. Akaranya venu ranitam saha krishna sara. Pujam dadhur virachitam pranayavalokai. Danyas mamudha gatayopi harinyeta. Yananda nanda namupata vichitravesham. Akaranya venu ranitam saha krishna sara. Pujam dadhur virachitam pranayavalokai. Danyas mamudha gatayopi harinyeta. Yananda nanda namupata vichitravesham. Akarnya venu ranitam saha krishna sara. Pujam dadhur virachitam pranayavalokai.
Krishna Sara.
Danya. Fortunate, blessed. Sma. Certainly. Mudha Gataya. Having taken birth in an ignorant animal species. Api. Although. Parinya. She dear. Eta. These. Ya. Who. Nanda Nandanam. The son of Maharaj Nanda. Upata Vichitravesham. Dressed very attractively. Akarnya. Hearing. Venu Ranitam. The sound of his flute. Saha Krishnasara. Accompanied by the black deer. Their husbands. Pujam Dadhu. They worshipped. Virachitam. Performed. Pranaya Avalokai. By their affectionate glances. Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Blessed are all these foolish deer, because they have approached Maharaj Nanda's son, who is gorgeously dressed and is playing on his flute. Indeed, both the doe and the bucks worship the Lord with looks of love and affection. Purport. This translation is quoted from Srila Prabhupada's Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjha 1736. According to the Acharyas, the gopis were thinking as follows. The female deer can approach Krishna along with her husbands because Krishna is the ultimate object of affection for the male deer. Because of their affection for Krishna, they are encouraged by seeing their wives attracted to him and thus consider their household lives fortunate. Indeed, they become joyful upon seeing how their wives are searching after Krishna and following along. They urge their wives to go to the Lord. On the other hand, our husbands are jealous of Krishna, and because of their lack of devotion to him, they cannot even stand to smell his fragrance. Therefore, what is the use of our lives? Om Gyan Timurandesha Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshur Mitanyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Tarubhischa Kribasindhi Devacha Patitano Pavanibyo Vaishnavibyo Namo Namaha. So this purport, it says, according to Acharyas, is directly taken from Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's purport on this verse. It's a very interesting comparison with the deer. We are starting to hear in this chapter the gopis glorifying the different residents of Vrindavan, the flute, and so many of the different inhabitants of Rajadham. And at the same time, they are lamenting their misfortune. So they are extolling the virtues of all of these different residents, even the deer, the simple animals in Vrindavan, and comparing to their own lack of good fortune. In this example today, we're seeing that the deer, it says first they're considered to, they says foolish deer, because they're considered just to be less intelligent. Not that they're doing anything foolish, but they're a less intelligent form of life than human beings. But they say even though that they may be less intelligent, a deer would be considered not as intelligent as a human being, so that they are so much more fortunate because both the male and the female deer share in their devotion to Krishna. So they were contrasting this with their own position where they say their husbands were jealous of Krishna and didn't appreciate Krishna. And so therefore they feel very, very unfortunate, while the deer, the female deer, is actually encouraged by her husband, the male deer. They go together to see Krishna, to worship Krishna, with great affection, gazing upon Krishna's beautiful form. The gopis do not have that situation. Rather, they have to be rather furtive. They have to sneak out in the night. They have to disobey their husbands, disobey their families. Of course, this all adds to the rasa. This adds to the love, adds to the deepest feelings that the gopis exhibit, that they actually, it's not easy for them. It's not that everything is set up for them to just have this very easy, enjoyable relationship with Krishna. Rather, it all seems externally difficult, that they have to go through so many trials and tribulations, and they have to try to avoid their husbands and their mother-in-laws and all of these personalities to be able to be with Krishna. So Of course, the relationship with the gopis and their husbands is a very complex affair, which we're not going to go into today. You can read about that, especially in chapter 29 of the 10th canto, and in our BBT edition of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the authors quote extensively throughout many, many verses from the commentaries of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur verbatim, and there's a very, very deep understanding of the relationship of the gopis, the relationship with Krishna, the relationship with their husbands. Basically, the summary is that some had relationships with their husbands and their material bodies, some did not. There was only externally or superficially the semblance of a relationship. It's described that some of those who were not completely on the purified stage may have had a material relationship, but yet, at one point it says when they were forbidden to go to the rasa dance by their husbands, so they gave up their bodies. Vishwanathan has explained that that means that they gave up their material bodies and they became completely purified. The last remnants of any possible material attachment was gone. And then they fully appreciated and they fully enjoyed with Krishna in their spiritual bodies. So anyway, it's a very complicated matter. There's many, many verses and pages of description of that that we can understand. But the idea is that they basically, within the material, so-called or material perspective, they were inhibited in their relationship with Krishna. But of course, they enjoyed it fully in their spiritual bodies. So we can see how this is a real issue and a real problem. This is something we can actually relate to in this material world, that if one of a husband or wife, if one partner is not very favorable to Krishna consciousness, how it causes so many difficulties. And we've seen this many times, that a husband or a wife may be coming to Krishna consciousness, and if the partner is either not favorable or even inimical, it can cause so many difficulties. And it becomes a real conflict and a real struggle that the people have to work out. But then we see on the other hand, when both husband and wife are favorable to Krishna consciousness or come to Krishna consciousness together, get married after they are devotees, then that creates, of course, a very favorable situation. The idea is that, just as we saw here, even in Vrindavan, how the husbands were jealous of the time and the attention that their wives were giving to Krishna, we want to make sure that we don't do that type of thing. We want to make sure that we encourage everyone, our family members, our partners, fully in devoting themselves to Krishna. And even times you see this with devotees. Sometimes a husband or wife may become a little jealous if one of the partners is very devoted and wants to spend a lot of time in devotional service or whatever it may be, whatever that particular service that might be seeming to take them away from their household responsibilities. Of course, there has to be a balance here. One has to, and of course, a devotee becomes very expert attending to everything, taking care of one's household duties and at the same time taking care of one's spiritual duties and seeing to one's sadhana and to one's Krishna consciousness, to one's bhakti, which becomes primary. The devotee also understands that as jivas, we are all considered prakriti. There is one purusha, there is one enjoyer, and that is Krishna. And therefore, it is not for me to enjoy my wife and family, and not for the wife to try to enjoy the husband, but yet, rather, we are all trying to give enjoyment to Krishna. And we work together, we work cooperatively in that spirit of giving pleasure to Krishna, of giving service to Krishna. Then actually everything becomes very nice. And the family and the relationship becomes very happy if we have that understanding. So a devotee takes pleasure when they see another devotee advance. We all know this principle. When a devotee is doing some wonderful service, we glorify them. We're happy to see it. It's not that there's some shortage. That if someone is doing so much service, there won't be any service left for me. Or somebody is getting so much, is enjoying a loving relationship, then there's not going to be enough for me. That's a material concept. In the spiritual world, spiritual love, bhakti, is always increasing. And that the more we give bhakti, the more we perform bhakti, and the more we encourage bhakti in others, the more bhakti there is available for all of us. Because Krishna is completely unlimited, and his devotion and devotional service is completely unlimited. So therefore, in the ideal situation, husband and wife should serve and worship Krishna together, encouraging one another, just as we saw our example here of the gopis are giving of the deer, how the deer just very together appreciated Krishna, the husbands would appreciate their wives going to see Krishna, and therefore they were all happy because they were understanding this higher principle that we are all simply servants, we are all Prakriti, we are all meant to be enjoyed by Krishna. And therefore, when we're in our constitutional position, the living entity is completely happy and satisfied. You know, so we don't have to worry so much because rather, the more that we become Krishna conscious and the more that we help those in our family and those around us to be Krishna conscious, then it's only going to be a favorable situation for everybody. Okay. At the same time, I always just want to add, because somebody will probably ask, this sometimes is taken to an extreme where someone will abandon one's responsibilities in the name of being Krishna conscious, and actually it's not Krishna conscious. Because Krishna consciousness means that you're satisfying everyone. If someone is unsatisfied, then that's not really a good devotional platform. So everybody should be pleased by our devotion. So we should take care of our family members nicely, take care of those responsibilities, and at the same time, make sure that our greater responsibility to seeing to our Krishna consciousness and the Krishna consciousness of others is also there. So I wanted to say a few words on this verse, very, very nice verse, very wonderful chapter here, glorification of Krishna, the residence of Vrindavan. And I wanted to turn to one other idea. Today, as you all know, is the 4th of July, known as Independence Day. So I thought that the idea of this being Independence Day is obviously great material for a Bhagavatam class, so I couldn't resist talking a little bit about Independence Day. What does independence mean? Independence is a very important concept in America. It's almost part of the secular religion, in a sense, or understanding of America. It's so connected with our history, with our culture. The 4th of July was the signing of the Declaration of Independence, wasn't it? Yeah, isn't that what we're observing? I just forgot for a moment. What is actually 4th of July? Yeah, the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And, of course, the Declaration of Independence was a very, very important document in America. And, of course, many other countries now also hold this idea of freedom or independence very, very strongly. People fight wars for independence. There's tremendous struggles involved in getting this idea of freedom. So everybody wants to be free. Everybody wants to not be controlled by others. That's kind of our nature, particularly in this material world. Now, of course, in America, a lot of the main motivation was to become freedom from taxes and economic exploitation. It wasn't all just lofty philosophical and political motivation. Much of it was, it was often described as a middle class revolution, because it was basically the merchants and those who were the most upset by what they considered the oppressive economic situation, the sanctions and the taxes that England was putting on the colonies. Of course, that was the idea of having a colony. These powerful countries wanted to have colonies so they could exploit those colonies, so they could, so that they could get the resources and money and from them. So naturally, there was some backlash. Now, of course, others like Thomas Jefferson took this a little further to a little higher ideals, and they actually created more of a philosophical and political meaning out of this. So then you have this idea of freedom, of the idea of the inalienable rights of man. This was a very, very fundamental foundation of the doctrine of the Declaration of Independence. This idea that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were inalienable rights. Inalienable is kind of like constitutional position. It's like your Sarup Dharma is to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They really is thinking that way. They're saying that this is not something that's granted by man or man's laws. This is something that is inherent, it's natural, almost part of God's laws, to the degree that they were theistic. So there was very, very strong feelings about this. And of course, a lot of this came out of former, many philosophers like Hobbes and John Locke. John Locke, in the early 1700s, first propounded the idea of the natural rights of man. But it was interesting. Locke's rights of man were life, liberty, and pursuit of property. Seriously. It was life, liberty, and pursuit of property. One time he called it estate. That was what you had a right to control your property, your material things. And it is very, very important to people. Now, Jefferson was a little bit more idealistic, so he thought, it didn't quite sound right, so he put pursuit of happiness instead of pursuit of property. He thought, that gave it a little bit more idealistic, character to it. But this idea was these inalienable rights were something inherent, that we had a right to be free. Which is interesting because our Krishna consciousness understanding is that we are all totally dependent upon Krishna. That Krishna is the supreme controller, he's the supreme enjoyer, and he's the supreme friend of every living entity. So we have this idea that our goal is to completely surrender to Krishna. And we see that our problem in this material world is lack of surrender. That everyone wants to be the controller rather than to be controlled. That everybody wants to be the predominator rather than the predominated. Rather than they want to be master rather than to be servant. So we have this sort of conflict. And sometimes we find that that's a challenge in our preaching. Because what we are saying goes a little bit against what people are very much enculturated to think, especially in our Western society, which has these ideas of freedom and independence and control very, very strongly within it. Now, why do they have such strong desires? What is this? Where does this come from? Usually, if we look at anything that has some strong philosophical or political or psychological strong underpinning like this, there's something behind it that's real. In other words, everything in the material world is a perverted reflection of the spiritual world. So this doesn't come from nowhere. Why do people want independence? Because it is also part of our nature. Krishna is called Svarat. He is, right, from the very first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, right? Isn't that in 111? Which means he's the supreme independent. Krishna is completely independent. He can do whatever he wants. Now, what about us? The living entities, of course, are part and parcel of Krishna, and we know that we have the same, or at least not all, but we have many of the same qualities of Krishna, but in small quantities. So Prabhupada often uses the adjective minute when he talks about the independence of the living entity, that we have this minute independence, a very, very small degree of independent action. That is inherent within us. That is something that is part of our nature, that we have independence. And of course, that's also, it could be a very long discussion, but in a nutshell, why are we independent? Otherwise, there would be no loving relationship between Krishna and the jivas. Without independence, without freedom, you cannot have love, right? Someone can't put a gun to your head and say, you have to love me. I mean, they can control you, they can make you do something, but they certainly can't make you love them. Love is a free act of will. So there is that small amount of free will that every living entity has. So, how do we reconcile this? We do have that independence, we have free will, but we say we are also completely dependent upon Krishna. So what does it come down to? The living entity has the free will to be to accept Krishna or to accept Maya. That's pretty much what it comes down to. We can make the choice, to come into this material world and actually then be controlled by the three modes of nature, or we can use our independence wisely and surrender to Krishna and enjoy our constitutional position of loving relationship with him. So we have a choice. But if we choose to come to this material world, as every one of us in this room has done, we made that choice because the jiva is marginal, because we're tatashta shakti, which means we can become covered over. We have the choice to either be in the spiritual atmosphere or the material atmosphere. And so because we are marginal potency, we have the tendency to misuse the independence that we have. That small amount of freedom or free will that we have is misused, and then we come into this material world, and now are we free? No. As is stated in the Bhagavad Gita 15.7, Prakriti Stani Karshati, the living entities in this conditioned world are struggling hard with the modes of nature. So by misuse of our independence, we come into this material world, and rather than having this wonderful, independent, free experience, which we may have imagined, or I don't know what we imagined, but it didn't happen. What we got was the three modes of material nature. What we got was birth, death, disease, and old age. What we got was the three, the threefold miseries, and all of the difficulties and problems and suffering that is here within the material world. In the purport to 15.7, Srila Prabhupada says, he explains this nicely. He says, similarly, the separated expansions of living entities have their identities. As fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, the living entities also have fragmental portions of his qualities, of which independence is one. Every living entity as an individual soul has his personal individuality and a minute form of independence. By misuse of that independence, one becomes a conditioned soul, and by proper use of independence, he is always liberated. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, that we use this word liberated, becoming free. In other words, we're saying that when surrendering to Krishna, but the result is being liberated, being free. In either case, he is qualitatively eternal, as the Supreme Lord is. In his liberated state, he is freed from this material condition, and he is under the engagement of transcendental service unto the Lord. In his conditioned life, he is dominated by the material modes of nature, and he forgets the transcendental loving service of the Lord. As a result, he has to struggle very hard to maintain his existence in this material world. So, coming into this material world and coming under the control of the material energy is our real loss of independence. Now we are no longer independent. We are no longer free. The living entity in its pure state, the pure spirit soul, is free. When we take on these modes of nature, when we take on this material body, we lose our freedom because we are controlled. We are controlled in this hard struggle for material existence at every moment. We are controlled by the senses. We are controlled by the mind. We are controlled by other living entities. It's a false sense of freedom. And under illusion, the living entity thinks I am free, even though I am struggling life after life after life. Real freedom, real liberation, is giving up this material concept and surrendering to Krishna. So when we become free of material desire, become free of the material modes of nature, that is the beginning of freedom. Srila Prabhupada's purport, 3.13.39, Bhagavatam, he says, the qualification of bhakti, or devotional service to the Lord, is that the devotee should be free from all material contaminations and desires. This freedom is called vairagya, or renouncement. Renouncement is the word. Uses renouncement of material desires. One who engages in devotional service to the Lord according to the regular principles is automatically freed from material desires. In that pure state of mind, one can realize the personality of Godhead. So Srila Prabhupada several times talked about the four regular principles as the four regular principles of freedom. Again, that seems a little ironic to the non-devotee or the materialistic person who thinks, how is this free? I enjoy all of these things. I enjoy meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex life, gambling. So you're saying, restrict myself. This vairagya, or renouncing material desires. This seems like a restriction, like an imposition. But in reality, Prabhupada is saying that one who engages in devotional service is freed from these material desires. By freeing ourselves of these material propensities, then one actually is able to enjoy their real nature and life and real freedom. So we have to realize our constitutional position, our real inherent position, which is not necessarily the pursuit of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Although that will also be there. That will come along with it. We will have real life, we will have real freedom, and we will be happy. So we'll get all of those things as well. Not only will we get spiritual life, we get the whole Declaration of Independence thrown in too. So it's really a much better approach. Okay. So we know our real position is Jivera Sarupa Hayak Krishna Nityadas, that we are eternal servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We are eternal Nityadas, eternally the servant of Krishna. And there's real freedom and real happiness in that. And our nature is Satchidananda. If we're looking at what is the real constitutional position, so we are eternal, we are full of knowledge, and we are full of happiness, ananda, bliss. So therefore, when a devotee comes to Krishna consciousness, takes up bhakti yoga, and becomes a little advanced in Krishna consciousness, we experience real freedom, as real freedom from suffering in this material world, freedom from death, and freedom from ignorance. So those are the opposite of Satchidananda. If one is not blissful, one is suffering. If one is not eternal, you experience death in this material world. And if one doesn't have the chit potency of knowledge, then one experiences ignorance. So that is the real freedom that the devotee has in this material world, even, what to speak of in the spiritual world. That we become free from these, what Prabhupada would call the greatest calamities of life. That we don't have to experience the suffering of birth, death, disease, and old age. And therefore, we can understand that for me, my real Independence Day was sometime in 1972 when I came in contact with Srila Prabhupada and took up the devotional service. So we can also celebrate this Independence Day of perhaps the day that we took to the process of devotional service. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Aye. So, questions, comments? Howdy, Dave.
I think for many of us, we thought or were cajoled into a false sense of freedom as young people. We heard this mantra, what was it, tune in, turn on, and drop out.
That really worked for us.
Yeah, that didn't work too well. But anyway, the idea was there to drop out of a structure that we felt was confining. But then there was no alternative structure. I mean, groups went out to the country, but then they came crawling back with their tails between their legs because it was hard to live out in the country with no experience. But it was there was a tendency there, I think. And by Krishna's grace, Prabhupada came and right at the right time, because I think most of us were primed to search out that true independence or true freedom.
I think it's a really a good point, and we can see it certainly wasn't coincidence that Srila Prabhupada came at the right time. Obviously, part of Krishna's whole arrangement that sent Srila Prabhupada at just the perfect time in history to come to the Western world. And as you mentioned, many of us at that time, we were very frustrated with material life, and in a sense were renouncing many things of our material culture, material life, but of course our mistake was often to look for other types of sense gratification. We were just substituting one for another, and that really doesn't, you know, gain any eternal benefit. But because that, I guess, that questioning or that seeking or looking for something else, something different was there for many young people, they were able to take to Krishna consciousness when Srila Prabhupada presented it, you know, so purely and so wonderfully that we became attracted, because it gave us what we were really looking for. It satisfied that desire of the soul. Yeah. Ms. Prabhu?
I've got a question, yeah. Supposing Srila Prabhupada actually came here to this country tomorrow, or right now. I mean, how do you see that things... It sounds like you think things are different from that period compared with now. So perhaps you could...
What would it be like if Srila Prabhupada came now? Well, I'm sure it would have great effect as well. It's interesting because if you talk to people who are, you know, devotees, you know, not so much myself, but I I try to stay in touch with those who are really on the front lines of preaching and book distribution and, you know, doing a lot of, and who are, and just different devotees who are doing different outreach, engagements like that. Many, many devotees feel that it's a very, very good time right now, that it's a very, very favorable time for spreading Krishna consciousness. And we're seeing in different areas, different places where many new devotees are coming again. We can see things like, the interest in, ecology, the interest, you know, vegetarianism is growing, interest in yoga, meditation, this whole sort of movement to for more simple living or more natural, you know, the type of things like what we're going to be doing with our eco farm here. There's great attraction for that. There's a great mood in our country people who are looking for alternatives to materialism. So, I think the Krishna Conscious Movement is in a great place to really expand and to really increase our preaching. Of course, if Srila Prabhupada were here, we'd be going many times faster, of course, by his purity. But Srila Prabhupada left the rest of it for us. So, you know, he got it. He started us. He trained us. He told us what to do. He gave us the instruction. He said, this is what now we need to do, us and future generations of devotees. So Prabhupada's given us the roadmap, and we have to fill it out now. Anybody else? Yes. Over here, ladies.
Thank you, Prabhupada, for the class. Just a quick question. Even though we're not independent of Krishna, he does allow us a free will. And I've seen sometimes in the effort of helping a person fulfill their potential, wives, husbands, fathers, they get involved, or parents, they get involved in another person's life or in another person's progress, trying to force something onto them, not allowing them to experience it for themselves or not allowing them to come to their own realization. And again, it's an effort to help them, but again, everyone does have free will. Mm-hmm. So what would be your approach in maybe asking kind of some freedom of choice?
Well, that's a very good point, because ultimately everyone does have to make a free choice. And despite our best efforts, sometimes family members, friends, whatever, do not become Krishna conscious. Our own children sometimes leave Krishna consciousness. And that's very much there because that free will is there. As far as the approach, it takes expertise. And it really does, because there's a very I don't know if it's a fine line, but there is a line between we do want to encourage people in Krishna consciousness, we do want to preach to them, we want to try to bring out the best, and we also don't want to push them away and be overbearing or have, you know, in such a way that'll have the opposite effect. The best thing I can offer is that people listen to you when they know that you're concerned about them, when there's love, when there's relationship. If you have a relationship with somebody, you can talk to them very openly and honestly. If they feel that there's not a real relationship, if you're trying to manipulate them or just trying to force them and you don't really care deeply about them, they're not going to listen. So I think that the best thing to do with people that we're hoping to become Krishna conscious or more Krishna conscious is keep a deep, loving relationship with them as much as we can. I mean, it may not be an intimate relationship depending upon, you know, the situation, but, you know, but show that care and concern, and then we're more likely to be successful. Okay, anything else? Trivikram?
Just a quick comment on the deal. They're termed the foolish deer. But in the Manusmriti, it stated that land where the spotted deer roams is fit for habitation. Where it is absent, it is considered inauspicious. That's in the
Manusmriti. Where is that from?
In the Manusmriti.
Oh, Manusmriti.
And also, I think I saw...
So it's auspicious where deer are.
Yeah, where deer are roaming, okay. Yeah.
Well, we have lots of them around here.
I think it might be also in the Srimad Bhagavatam, some part. Yeah. I seen.
Okay. Back to you. Okay. One more, maybe. Yamaraj, last comment or question?
Yes, quick comment. Thank you for such a nice class, Prabhu. When you were responding to the Mataji about loving relationships and appreciation, and I was thinking, because I often talk to my wife about this sometimes, about how I think we should appreciate the temple devotees more here at New Ramanariti. Like have pictures up, you know, like in the in Krishna house, they have the pictures of the temple devotees and had the pictures there and everything. Because they're like on the front lines doing...
We'd have to have about 1,000 pictures up here.
Yeah. But I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about like the ones who do cooking and some of the pujaris and stuff like that. Yeah.
That's a very wonderful comment that Yamaraj made. And if you didn't hear that, I think we should all echo that more and really appreciate the devotees who are, you know, doing... the work, that the service that really keeps everything going here, that many of us just come in and are able to appreciate, you know, this wonderful temple, wonderful service that's here. And it doesn't happen by itself magically. It happens by the dedicated service and hard work of so many devotees. So thank you for mentioning that for us. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.